a special education teacher, an administrator, and a lawyer walk into a bar. And our conversations can get pretty lively. And now you'll join us while we talk all about special education and the public school system. I'm Robin Fabiano, a special education teacher and a building-based student services administrator. And I'm joined by Abby Hanscom, a district-level student services administrator, and Angela Smagula, a founding partner at Kahn & Smagula, specializing in education law. We've been working together across multiple districts since 2009 and have lots of opinions about special education. In this podcast, we hope to share information, lessons learned, interviews with VIPs in the field of special education, and bring some humor to an otherwise serious topic. But before we get started, three disclaimers. One, the views shared on this podcast are our own and don't represent the views of the districts in which we work. Two, everyone might want Kahn and Smagula as their attorneys, but Angela is not giving legal advice during this podcast. Three, although there are federal laws governing special education, we work in Massachusetts, a state that has added protections, so some of which we speak about may not apply in your state. So let's get started. Hi, Abby.
Hey, Robin.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
Good. So after making fun of Angela coming late.
Yeah, you did.
She's actually not here tonight. And right. She will be back next week. We feel really badly. Her dog is not doing well. And we're sending love out to Willie and hope that everything's okay.
I know. He's like a junior podcast member.
It's true. He's in the room every time we podcast. So it's like he joins us. I would say your dog does the same thing.
Yep. There we are.
I do not have a dog, so nor do I want one. But I like looking at yours from over Zoom. So both Abby and I get articles sent to us, and I have two sources that send headlines of educational articles, and they're from The Nation, from the Commonwealth, etc. And we came across an article that piqued both of our interests, and Abby sent it out to the group for us to consider doing a podcast. And I thought, oh my gosh, I just read that too.
I guess one of the things I would say is that after graduate school, nobody reads articles anymore, right? So you have to figure out a way to kind of curate your news feed as a professional in a way that you're getting a variety of input. And you are staying abreast of things. And so the proliferation of newsletters and other kinds of very short digest electronic media is really awesome and super helpful. And so I probably have, like, no lie, like six of them that come through every day or every week. And they're very helpful. And so tonight I do think it's going to be interesting. I think we want to acknowledge that this is a bit of a controversial topic and that people listening to this may have very strong opinions or may have no opinion, but we want to balance the conversation as much as we can. So the title of the article kind of gives away the topic, which is essentially a well-researched, quite long article regarding ABA therapy. And we'll get into why there's a controversy in a minute, but essentially there's a recently released meta-analysis, which is a super research study that consolidates, you know, all the existing smaller research studies and draws larger themes and conclusions related to the effectiveness of a variety of autism therapies. The title of the article is America's Most Popular Autism Therapy May Not Work and May Seriously Harm Patients' Mental Health. So that's a whopper of an article, and it gets your attention right away. So maybe we can jump in.
Well, we actually did a podcast summarizing an article in the Globe, the Boston Globe.
Yeah.
I think it might have been, I forget if it was an op-ed or an interview.
The dad's perspective.
Right? Yep. Right. The dad actually was declining placement in a school for his son, who his methodology fell under the umbrella of ABA because he felt like it was so damaging. So for those of you who are interested in this topic, there is another podcast similar to this topic, you know, I think maybe two seasons ago. And this is controversial because I would say almost every single report that you get from an outside neuropsychologist for a student with an autism diagnosis calls for an ABA program or ABA methodology infused throughout their program. And I have not seen an evaluation without that recommendation in years, probably since the early 2000s.
So that may just be us, Robin. That may just be us in New England, near a major medical center, you know, in a suburban context. I don't know that that's true for everybody listening to this across the country and globally. And the reality is that applied behavior analysis, which is the branch of cognitive psychology from which ABA stems, and we call it ABA in the field, is very popular in our region of the country. Whether or not that's true everywhere, I'm not totally sure. This article does speak to some of the national issues, and we can jump into them if you want. I did want to just call out the author and the name of the publication. So the article is written by Beth Hawkins, and it was published on March 6th, and it is from a newsletter on education, which is called The 74. And we'll put all that information in the notes if people want to read this article later.
So the controversial part of the article, if we were to sum it up in a couple of sentences, is that ABA methodology, as reported by adults with autism who are reflecting back on their educational experience, felt restrictive, harmful, punitive, and essentially focused on aligning them with social norms versus embracing their unique ASD characteristics. So for example, they talk about stimming, and stimming for many autistic people is a useful strategy to calm their body down or to regain attention or soothe themselves. And the article talks about how some people experienced ABA programs where they were forced to not stim, which then caused them, you know, lots of trauma as they moved on through their educational experience.
Right. So there are actually two kind of prongs to the article. So the most important one, obviously, is the impact on the individual children and young adults, right? So that's the most important thing we should talk about tonight. The second prong is this very interesting statement that ABA as a methodology may not be effective. And that's a different issue, right? And that has to do with a research analysis, and we can talk about that as well. I think both of those things are nested inside the history of ABA as well as the economics of ABA. And so maybe we start there and then we can go into both things.
Yeah, let's start with the history. So so ABA is a science, and it is the science of behavioral change. And Lovaas is, I think, the father of ABA. The premise is that behavior is an action, and you can manipulate an action by looking at the antecedents and the consequences and shaping the behavior by changing those two things on sort of either side. And so it can be used in a variety of settings, not just the educational setting, and it can be used in people have jobs in like organizational management and look at big culture shifts and changes. You know, we've heard about this through like animal science and animal training. And then it started to be used in educational settings by Lovaas, who originally had a study with, you know, so many kids and was able to manipulate their behavior. And as a result, IQ test scores went up, students regained communication skills, they had a decrease in maladaptive behaviors, and all of those things then became generalized to other disciples and behaviorists. And that's how ABA became an instructional methodology in education.
The timing of his kind of culminating article is 1987. So that's another really important kind of date marker. And that's, I don't know about you, that's like the year I graduated from high school. So if you think of all the work on this field after this big article that he published, kind of summarizing his life's work, he had been doing this through the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, has been in the education zeitgeist since about 1987. And that also aligns with an increasing awareness of autism and an increasing like epidemiological finding of the number of children with autism. And so we've seen that number go down. So nowadays, and this number is so different than our, when we trained as teachers, I think the current stat is that one in 34 American children might be autistic. And that number seems striking. That number, though, is composed out of specific metrics from only a very few countries. And so it's not really a global true average number. But you see that number in the press quite a bit as people are talking about this issue.
I actually feel like that number has changed because I feel like it was one in like much lower than 34 at one point. Is that
yep.
feel that way too? I think one four has now gone, would we say up or down, right?
I'm just looking it up. So the US number, if you just look at the number of US children identified as autistic, currently sits at one in 36.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. And then when you see the World Health Organization number for autism, it's usually, my understanding, is composed of Canada, the United States, and a few other countries, but it's not considered really a global number, even though when you hear it, you think it is because it's the World Health Organization. So it's just important to know what's behind the numbers. But so Lovaas put this article out, said, I can change kids' behavior. I can make people who are autistic not look autistic. And the industry was born because of the desire to help children and parents' extreme, you know, love and care for their children and the medical community's desire to help children. The recipe for an applied behavior analysis model took root, and it definitely took root in the region of the country we are in and near medical centers. Right. So we know that that's like a fact. And that taking root into hospitals then led to reports that went to school districts that then school districts responded to parents' requests to build programs. And now we have this very embedded and entrenched kind of ABA methodology in public schools in New England. Additionally, at the same time, the federal government was looking at it for the army schools, for the military school complex, which is this very vast school system. And when they adopt a methodology, it's a tremendous boon to the people who offer those services because it's a giant system, but it's also like locked in as a federal contractor. And so ABA came in to the military system to provide special education resources to children of people in the military with autism, which is a giant market. And that has contributed to some of the things that pop up in this article. And then finally, when you do business with the federal government, you have to be able to like do some reimbursement codes that are kind of like insurance coding. And the ABA lobby successfully got themselves coded for reimbursement for federal dollars through Medicare. And right. when that happened, then the whole industry exploded even further out of public schools to what we now see, which is an entire shadow economy marketplace of autism schools that children are living in our communities who the districts are unaware of and have not child found. Because they've never been registered in their school system because they are attending a for-profit insurance-based early intervention, preschool, and up through kindergarten, first grade, second grade. And so this year it's not uncommon that a district will receive a student who's 6, 7, 8, 9, who's aged out of this service or their insurance has stopped paying for some reason, and they're entering public school for the very first time. So that's another very strange development. There's really not another market like that for another kind of disability population that I'm aware of that has evolved into such a full economic model. And you can imagine that it is potentially damaging to some families and kids, and maybe very helpful to some other families and kids, right?
Yeah. I mean, it really is incredible if you think about the insurance-based market out there in the private companies, because they can't even keep up with the clients and the client needs. I didn't actually realize about the private preschools. I know that ABA centers do like preschool groups and preschool centers. I didn't realize that after age six, they could keep going, because that's when the child needs to be in public school, unless they're homeschooled, or unless, right, they're on a homeschool plan, or if they go to, I guess it's the same thing as going to private school, right? They're an accredited school.
They are not. So that's the other thing, is that that industry is now so young that our, certainly in our state education agency has yet to fully develop a monitoring system or an accrediting system for them. So they would not be approved special education programs like we're familiar with that are audited. They're for-profit companies. So if you want to get a little spooky on this for a minute, the article includes a private like equity hedge funds report on the ABA market. And so I printed it out and read it and spooked myself a little bit this evening. But so broadly speaking, they're looking at this prospectus for future investors into their like hedge fund that is looking at the ABA industry as an investment model. And what they're saying is ABA is a mature scientific discipline that focuses on the analysis, design, implementation, and evaluation of social and other environmental modifications to produce meaningful changes in human behavior. It's not just for autism. They're marketing it for anxiety, ADHD, personality disorders, developmental delays, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress, sleep deprivation, and substance abuse. And so they're saying to these potential investors, this is like a great investment vehicle, because look at the many, many markets that this methodology could be applied to. And then they're talking about the idea that the marketplace is growing. So they're citing these CDC numbers that we talked about earlier. They're talking about market share. And the market share is interesting because there's been a consolidation of vendors, the little companies. Like, we had friends who started little companies, and
right.
I remember, you know, husband and wife, mom and pop shop, you'd be married to some BCBA and you'd start a little consulting company. All of those are similar to like funeral homes, have been purchased up, and there are now 9 major national vendors that own all the ABA major companies. And those vendor companies aren't necessarily educational enterprises.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's like charter schools being owned by businesses.
Yeah. So all of that is happening. And then they cite to 2019 as really the time that this whole situation ignited. So that's really when the Autism Cares Act of 2014 started to mature, and over $3 billion was dedicated for ASD treatment throughout a variety of agencies. And that continued all the way through into 2020 through a variety of different like federal laws. And now there are 4 main players. One was acquired by Blackstone Investments, which is like a major investment. They're in 24 states and 221 locations with 2,500 employees.
Wow.
Yep. The next one was acquired by Moran Capital in 12 states with 810 employees. And then the 2 smaller ones were acquired in 2017 in 17 states, 160 locations, over 500 employees. And the littlest guy was acquired in 2017, and they're only in 20 states, Robin. That's it. And they provide center-based services, home-based services, diagnostic, speech, OT, PT, and telehealth. And all of that was publicly available data. And so when you start reading it from this lens, you can kind of understand that there's a great risk to the children and families who are vulnerable to some of the marketing as well as some of the messaging, because there's a financial incentive to make a profit. In
sure.
These models.
Yeah. Sure.
And to return a profit to their investors.
Wow.
I know.
And blowing.
Yeah. So that's, you know, something to be aware of in the field.
Yeah. I can't think of any other like educational practice that we can compare that to. And I think it's because this methodology can be applied to so many different behaviors and so many different actions, right? That yep. you really could market the shit out of that to be applied in a ton of different situations. I think for me, it's like, how do they have all of this staff? Like, we can't find anyone to work. Like, how in the world are they having companies with this many people who are trained, which is like unbelievable that they could have companies with this many staff that could provide this service at such a level that has to be at least high enough to have some satisfaction, because you can't, you know, you're dealing with humans. And so, you know, if you don't do what you say you're going to do, you're going to get bad reviews and your company is going to go in the toilet. No one's going to use you. So you at least have to have some level of proficiency in terms of the people doing the work.
Totally. And if you want to give the most positive spin to this, you know, there are many people who are the 25-year-old us's of now who are entering the field now. And this marketplace player is a new option for your first job, your second job. Instead of being an aide, like I was an aide, you know, for a year, maybe you go work in this place and then you kind of cross over into public school or a private setting 2, 3, 4 years later. And perhaps they're better built than we are to provide consistent training because they're a company. So they actually have like the capacity to do things on scales that we don't, right? That being said, the problem with any kind of industry built around people who can't report their experience is scary, because you'd have right. to have a lot of ethical controls on that. And then also just the marketing to parents when they're very vulnerable. I think that's just a concern. So that is real, right? And that's a real phenomena in this field. I can't think of any other disability group or other therapy that has similarly evolved on this trajectory and at this speed and scale and into the middle of the pandemic. If you think about, imagine you've got a newly diagnosed little kid at home 4 years ago today when the national health emergency happened, and you're desperate for support and service, right? And the schools were closed for a while. And then we came back in a very staged way, and a for-profit company was probably more nimble.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Wow.
I know. So that's just one piece of the conversation. I think two interesting themes coming out of it. So one is, by going after these big operators like the federal government, these programs are now under scrutiny through the audit system of the federal government. So the article, if people are interested, includes a big analysis from the Joint Army Task Force on the efficacy of the Army's investment in the military schools and how kids fared in those programs. And so it's those, you know, there's research think tanks specific to looking to make sure those federal dollars are spent well on behalf of soldiers, families. And that article is interesting to read, but very specific to that world. Then there's a broader conversation about a big article that looked at the major therapies, of which ABA is only one, for autism, and looked at how effective they are. And maybe we can just take a couple minutes and talk about that.
Let's do that.
Okay. So in this perspective, ABA is just one of like six major therapies. The other ones are, they call them like a developmental approach, a naturalistic developmental behavioral intervention approach. These are all defined. TEACH, which I was trained in. Remember TEACH?
Yeah.
Anybody in North Carolina listening to this knows all about TEACH. A sensory-based model, so the sensory approaches. Yeah. Animal-assisted therapies. And then finally, technology-based therapies. And then back in 2019, over 6,000 individual families and students were surveyed. And then this organization ranked those six types of therapies by effectiveness. So proof of effectiveness, neutral to no, negative effectiveness. And they ranked ABA not very highly. And so that's kind of interesting.
What was the first one?
All right. Well, I'll tell you. So the in some of the, like, I don't know what you would call it, the critique of these things is very interesting too. So, okay. So essentially, one of the big critiques for ABA is that in general, the people reporting back on how effective it was worked for the companies that were providing the service. So there was an inherent reporting bias because the people reporting it worked for the companies. So that was like a very interesting circle. And the other one was that the other reporters were parents reporting and they had an investment in their kids doing well. So they were less reliable reporters of a critique, if that makes sense. So the promising intervention types, that was very funny. So the first one was this neurodevelopmental behavioral intervention, which is a blend of traditional behavior approaches plus developmental approaches. And it does remind me of what we would call floor time.
I was just thinking, like, yeah. why aren't we hearing that? And what was the other one? It started with an R. It was like relational.
Yep. Right? Yeah. Like, oh my God. I can't remember anymore. Yep.
Relational
therapies. Yep.
Yeah. It was something like that. And that was huge for a while. Yep.
So they believe that this research would say that the data on that, what they call NBDI, is strong for a positive result for kids. And then the other approach is the developmental approach. And that's really what we would think of as functional educational interventions matched to a kid's developmental level, and then incrementally moving them forward, but without a behavior lens.
That actually makes
me, when I were trained,
because that to me is like the most, I agree. I think that's the most effective because you're teaching usually within like natural contexts and, you know, able to generalize things more. It's interesting to me because when I talk about ABA in meetings with families, especially for the older kiddos, and we're moving away from tabletop discrete trial because the students are now, you know, 17, 18, 16, 17, 18, they're like in job settings and community-based settings. You know, I say to them, we can still look at teaching discrete skills and taking data on it and analyzing, you know, the students' progress and the effectiveness of our instruction outside of like a structured tabletop activity. Like, you can still do this methodology of identifying the skill, breaking it down, teaching it discreetly, assessing it, and then, you know, figuring out your data to decide whether or not, you know, you're moving in the right direction. You can do that anywhere. And that's a good teaching technique and good instruction.
The meta-analysis determined that ABA specifically had some evidence of effectiveness, but it wasn't as strong as the first two. And what they really banked that on was that frequently the studies that were cited for ABA were conducted by people who believed in ABA. So that has always been a critique of ABA, is that they kind of set up their own journals and set up their own ecosystem of research-based research and then kind of prove themselves to be right. And so whether, you know, you agree with that or not, the recommendation regarding ABA from this big report is that, quote, you know, states with insurance mandates that explicitly cover traditional behavior interventions should further revise their policies to also include the first two practices for insurance coverage, given that those two approaches have accrued substantial evidence for effects in young children on the autism spectrum. Right. And so I think that's just really interesting. Like, you don't have to get rid of ABA, but perhaps the universe is larger than ABA. And that's hard sometimes for people to hear.
I think it's hard because people would say that it is a science, right? You have to analyze the change and you use data and you are, you know, always observing how the environment and consequences are integrating with the behavior that you want to change. I think that they kind of look at it that concretely, or and they don't necessarily talk about like the impact on the person on the other side of the table, right? I think nowadays, though, there is something that we're hearing a little bit more, which is called like compassionate ABA,
right? Or
like ABA, where you are working with the client or the student to talk about what they want to work on. You're prioritizing, gathering their input. So it's not just a one-sided instruction. You're making a decision together around what the behavior that is that they want to change, and you're steering away from other behaviors that maybe are more, as we talked about before, like unique to the person or self-soothing or serve a function that, you know, could be really beneficial and helpful for them in a variety of ways. But I think, you know, that whole idea of compassionate ABA is like less about, you know, the drill and kill model, which I think some people remember from years ago, where you're like, you know, you have to acquire nouns before you can go on to verbs, and you can't prompt a sentence until you know at least 12 words. And it was very, very rigid. Yep. And I think that people have certainly moved away from that model and are trying now to incorporate the vision of the family, the strengths, weaknesses, et cetera. So it makes me feel good that they're moving in the right direction and evolved as an educational methodology.
Yep. And I think that those are all really good signs. The article gives a lot of advice for how ABA could pivot to resolve some of these issues. And in specific, what they say, you know, is that, the relatively low quality of their literature limits the confidence in the accuracy of the intervention. A notable exception is a single big study that did find standardized measures of cognition and language by independent evaluators. So they say, you know, though the positive results of this study are very encouraging, they've persisted without replication for over 20 years. That study was in 2000. And the dramatic increase in published studies in the intervening years since the study's publication stand as proof that high-quality group experimental investigations of autism-specific interventions are both possible and necessary. And I think that's cool, right? Like, you got to study yourself. And then the ones that were found to have little effectiveness of evidence of effectiveness were sensory interventions, teach, and animal-assisted interventions. And that's
I feel a little badly for the OTs with the sensory interventions, because I know that in many cases, you know, they're advocating for sensory diets and, you know, sensory input. And, you know, they're very much still looking at, like, remember, like, brushing programs and things like that, and drawing the magic eights over the side where eights to integrate, you know, both sides of your body. So that's interesting. I am surprised that teach wasn't found to be effective, because University of North Carolina is really, really has a strong reputation. And I'm surprised by that.
So it has to do with the fact that teach's model is so person specific. So what they say is, though teach was among the first interventions designed specifically for individuals with ASD, it also remains relatively understudied compared to several other interventions geared toward this population. Few eligible studies of teach were located, and most were quasi-experimental. And that's the reality, is that the way that worked was so person-specific and classroom embedded, that you can't just study it like a little science experiment.
Right.
So that may not mean that teach is ineffective. It means that you can't prove it with a research-based study at this time.
So when we write our IEPs and we say, you know, we will use a research-based instruction, and a parent asks for ABA, because that is the gold standard, or known as the gold standard for interventions for students with autism, is this going to change the way you respond?
Well, it certainly might be the kind of thing where I would say, I don't know that that's the only game in town, and we should think about pairing that with functional and developmental interventions, which I say anyway, because I believe that. But, you know, it is this particular article has hit the wires in terms of many administrators, many superintendents, many aspiring administrators. So I do think that this meta-analysis in particular will have some impact, but it's like a big, long, slow process, right? Because that has to impact the state departments of ed and then the professional organizations and all of that. So I don't think anything's going to change overnight, or should it? And just so you know, in terms of the animal assisted, just for a call out to Willie, animal assisted interventions, they did locate studies of animal assisted interventions, but there were too few to permit estimation of effect sizes. And the two interventions that were represented were both for canines, equine and canine, actually. And several of those relied on caregiver reports, because you can't interview the dog or the horse. And two were flagged for possible unreported conflicts of interest, as the authors currently provide the intervention in question for profit. And that goes right back to the beginning of what we were talking about. So we don't need to belabor this. I think it's a really cool article. And if people like meta-analyses, there's 51 pages of it.
Wow.
I know.
Well, Abby, I'm impressed, because it sounds like you read off 51 pages.
No, I tried my best. I'm out of practice. I'm kind of rusty. But let's pivot over and talk about people, because that's way, way more interesting. So people listening to the podcast might know about ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, ACE, and kind of that research that looks at over your childhood and your young adult life, if you acquire a certain, you know, number of adverse experiences, your risk goes up for certain things. And so out of that research has come some really interesting, compelling surveying of young adults with autism, and asking them to comment on their experience of childhood. And a number of them reported so many adverse experiences that they qualified for a diagnosis of PTSD.
100%.
So, you know, the thing we do is we reflect and grow and learn, and
totally. When you know better, you do better.
Okay. Yep. The research further goes on, and a lot of this is now self-report of individuals with autism, that there is actually a relationship between more people reported enough symptoms to qualify for PTSD diagnosis if they also reported having had ABA intervention as a child.
Right.
So that's correlation is not causation, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is those two factors lined up. And so again, that self-report and doesn't meet a lot of rigorous scientific standards. But when you read the self-report, like comments from people, it's very aligned with what we experience, where kids are saying like, I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. I felt like you were training me like a puppy, you know, like all of these comments that are hard, hard, hard to read. But really important to think about.
Wow. You know, so I shared this with this article with my BCBA, and, mm-hmm. you know, he said, it's hard for me not to be defensive about this. This is like my passion and my life work. And, you know, I have to rely on the fact that I am bound to ethics as part of my BCBA licensure and organization. And this is like what guides him. And so I looked up the principles, the ethics, mm-hmm. and the four pillars are the principles of behavior analysts should benefit others, treat others with compassion, dignity, and respect, behave with integrity, and ensure their own competence. We've talked about our own special education, you know, ethics. And, yep. you know, how it's important to keep revisiting those and make sure that those are the foundations of what guides us through our practice and our decision-making. And it felt good to me to know that the BCBAs also have an agency that, you know, has ethics and standards that they need to continue to receive continuing education and relicensure and things like that. And that made me feel like there is a level of oversight and professional growth in that organization that will move people along as research comes out and as people grow and learn. I mean, we talk about education being a young field, or at least special education being a young field. And this is even younger, because this, you know, as you said, really started becoming mainstream in the early 2000s, even though Lovaas published this in, you know, 1987. I mean, kids weren't even included in public schools until the mid to late 90s. So again, like the wave of this instruction was the 2000s. So it's a 20-year-old practice.
Yep.
Maybe it's really just in the last 10 years that things have really boomed in the way that they have. So again, it's a young practice. And so to have an organization that's providing guidance and professional development as more research comes out, you know, that's a positive.
Yep. And I can just speak from personal experience and say, having many BCBAs who I've worked with over the years and I've been friends with and colleagues with and have, you know, hired and supported and supervised and all of those things, I feel like in public schools in particular, we always are looking very carefully for people who have a very open mind, because not everybody wants ABA, right, in public school, and some parents don't want it at all. And so BCBAs who work in public settings usually have to be a little more eclectic than perhaps their more clinical colleagues that they went to grad school with who opted to not work in public settings. And we're always interviewing for that because we're looking for that flexibility of thinking on behalf of those people, because otherwise they'll take a job with us and then be sad and not last, right? And we don't want that for them or for the kids. So I feel really confident that there are very, very, very good people who are really like entrenched in these issues and care passionately about exactly these topics, taking very good care of kids. What's more concerning is that the field is doing this weird kind of industrification on top of really well-intentioned people. And that's just something to be aware of. And for parents and for people in our jobs to be aware of when you're interviewing and thinking about it.
Abby, if a family came to you and said, I read this article, I'm worried about the effectiveness of ABA, and I'm in a classroom in your district that, you know, set, you know, all of the program material and mission is like, we embed ABA methodology across the day, right? That's what we've said for some of our sub-separate programs. And now you have a parent that's like, I'm not really sure that's what I want. Mm-hmm. How do you think you would react, or what questions would you ask the family to engage in that type of conversation?
So I have that currently. I mean, that's like real reality. So in a big enough school system, there's always a small pod of people who believe in everything, all different things, right? So I've experienced that over the years. I had that in our old district, and I've had that in every place I've ever worked. And so what we do is we figure out with people what they mean when they say that. And then we try to honor their wishes on behalf of their kid. The thing with behaviorism is that everything is behavior. So nodding and smiling at someone in a meeting is behavior, right? And so usually what people, when you stop and work through it, are talking about is punitive, punishing, or restrictive methodologies. So we would say, okay, that makes total sense. We understand what you're saying. Sometimes it goes another step further, like no token economies, no checklists, no reinforcers. And that's a bigger conversation, because everything is a reinforcer, right? Proximity is a reinforcer. Time is a reinforcer. So you have to say, what do you mean by that? And then over time, building trust with people to understand that that we're going to take what they're saying seriously. And also we need them to understand the reality of school. School is a structured environment and controls children's behavior, independent of philosophy.
Right.
So I have those kind of conversations, and I'm really thoughtful. And, you know, I try to say we are a public school, so we're going to have like a schedule, and we're going to have times, and things are going to start and stop on a time schedule. And there will be a natural consequence if that doesn't work for your kid, and we'll work through that. But we can't remove that from the universe. But that's, you know, most people are very just concerned about the restrictiveness or a punishment based methodology. And I totally respect that.
Right. And I think also like the hand over hand physical manipulation sometimes that can happen with pretty restrictive programming. So we talk about like forcing eye contact, forcing hand positions, you know, forcing body positioning. And then reinforcing that to show that, you know, you're ready. And, you know, sometimes I think about myself and I'm leaning back in my chair and slouched and I'm still listening and I'm able to do that. And I don't need to be sitting up with my hands folded in my lap to be ready to hear something.
Yep, totally. And that's maybe the last thing we should talk about in this conversation is this idea of camouflaging. So there's this whole concept in autism land that, you know, some of the ABA methodologies were training people with autism to present like people who don't have autism. And there's a whole thing we could talk about, you know, in terms of like trying to pass in neurotypical world, whatever that means. And camouflaging is this term of like doing that. And, you know, the problem, of course, with that is that there's a psychic cost to that energy for people with autism. And it turns out that as more research is done interviewing people from a mental health lens who have autism, right, there is a much greater risk for suicidality for people who experience camouflaging as very stressful and exhausting to them. And so that's like an emerging area of research and really, really, really super important that has to be looked at because you would never want the accrual of all these little interventions to be so exhausting to a child that as a young adult, they are really despondent. And so that's kind of like the end of the whole article is looking at kind of the future of the research. And the idea is to really focus on mental health and mental wellness for kids with autism in school.
And yeah, I think that actually, that makes me think because we do see as students get older, this like dual diagnosis emerges around ASD and anxiety, ASD and depression, ASD and, you know, something else. And, you know, sometimes I wonder, is this part of the ASD profile? We talk about puberty and how puberty and hormones and just like the changing psyche of a teenager and young adults impact behavior and communication and all of that. But this article made me wonder if the experiences that students were having when they were younger in terms of their educational programming has then now impacted them as teenagers. And we're trying to give them a little bit more choice and voice and independence as we're like pushing transition and pushing independence and looking at post-secondary outcomes. Have we sort of created a situation through our very intensive and rigorous programming when they were younger, because again, that's what we were told to do, right? Like high intensity programs when kids were younger, or else you're going to miss out on something, you know, have we done more harm?
Yeah. And so I do think that the answer to all of that lies with asking people with autism what they want and what they think, and not coming up with like another set of disability related categories to wedge people into that further exacerbates the dynamic. And the good news is that the next generation of young people with autism have social media, they're digital natives, they're connected in ways that probably their elders weren't, and they have a strong voice. And I think their parents are more likely to support them using it. And, you know, maybe after listening to a podcast like this, some team member might someday say like, well, what do you think about that? And maybe, you know, if the student's saying, I don't want to do that, we should really honor that more than we might have in the past. And that's really interesting.
You know, we did also do one other podcast similar to this when we talked about the ASHA article, the speech and language article, where, you know, they are listening to young adults or adults with autism reflecting back on whether or not they want to, you know, as you said, like camouflage their disability or like change to fit into the social norms. And we have some students now who are rejecting speech and language to say like, I'm totally fine with how I am. Like you guys are the ones that are fucked up, but I feel really good about myself. So I'm going to stick with what I have. And, you know, it's just funny.
Yeah. And, you know, there are autistic self-advocates who would say, don't, you know, suck me into your flawed paradigm on disability.
Right.
Dear lady, like I didn't ask for that. Like, no, thank you. I would argue that there's a variety of people with autism and some people can articulate their experience better than others. And it's hard to know what the experience of kids who are very significantly compromised in terms of their expressive language what their experience truly is or was. And so I don't know that we'll ever have a full picture of this, but I think hearing from people who can tell us and want to tell us their experience is probably a very good place to start. And building schools that can be a little more flexible if a family kind of pivots fast. You know, sometimes we get people who come in very strong on ABA for 4 or 5 years and then suddenly pivot. And it's really hard for the team because we're like, what's happening? We just built you this whole thing and you demanded it and now you don't want it. And really understanding that that's coming from, you know, like a good place. Parents are trying to match what their kids are telling them. And it's challenging all the time, right?
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. So that was that article. I think we hopefully gave it enough of a balanced overview. And I hope that people who are listening to this who are BCBAs or in the behavior world understand that I do think that while there's a critique of ABA baked into this article, that the field is also a very capable field and full of good people who are really interested in continuous improvement. And that's really what I think the takeaway is, needs to happen.
Awesome. So we'll put a bunch of links in the show notes so you can do the deep dive like Abby did in the article, and then also maybe some of the professional organizations that we get our articles from as well, just as some examples, if you guys want some daily reading. And we can also link to the BCBA, their licensure board, and they can read up a little bit more about their ethics.
I think that's awesome. Terrific.
Awesome. All right. Thanks, Abby. Always good to talk to you, and we will be back next week. Night.
Yep. Take care. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating or review. If you have any questions, you can reach us at astalpodcast@gmail.com.